So the other important component of somatic experiencing is what I call pendulation.
Yeah.
So when a person first touches into these sensations, which they've been alienated or dissociated from,
yeah,
they'll feel a contraction. And again, we probably are going to be avoiding that. So the person has to be guided that, yes, there is a contraction, but every contraction is followed by an expansion, and every expansion by another contraction, and another expansion, and another contraction, and another expansion. Again, what I call pendulation.
Yeah.
And if maybe, you know, 100 years from now, probably the only thing I'll be known for is the word pendulation.
Pendulation.
Welcome back, my friends, to Grief is a Sneaky Bitch podcast. I'm your host, Lisa Kiefhammer. As I hope you've come to recognize through my conversations on this show over the years, through my TEDx talk, navigating your own grief journey, or from some other source, we are embodied beings. It's been said that actually we're not thinking beings who on occasion feel, rather we are emotional feeling beings who on occasion think. That means our grief, our stress, our trauma isn't just all in our head, as they say. In fact, as my previous guest, Emily Nagoski, reminds us, when a strong emotion or stressor gets blocked from discharging, as happens in significant emotional distress or traumatic event, we end up in a stuck place with that undischarged stressor living in our nervous system and causing us to operate from that place of flight or fight, freeze or fawn. So much of what we learn collectively in our grief illiterate world is that grief is just feeling sad, which just happens to be in your head. And that means if you're good enough or strong enough or tough enough, you can just think your way out of feeling bad and voila. You're all better. How I hate how this has permeated our collective psyche, causing us to should all over ourselves when we can't just snap out of it. That's why I'm overjoyed to share my conversation with today's guest, Peter A. Levine. He is the renowned developer of somatic experiencing, a naturalistic and neurobiological approach to healing trauma, which he's developed over the past 50 years. He holds a medical and biological physics doctorate from the University of California at Berkeley and a doctorate in psychology from International University. He is the recipient of 4 Lifetime Achievement Awards and is the author of several books, including Waking the Tiger, which has now been printed in 33 countries and has sold over 1 million copies. His memoir, An Autobiography of Trauma, A Healing Journey, will be published on April 9th of this year, and that's what we spend some of our time talking about in today's episode. And now, my Hungarian roots came out today as I learned from his memoir that he's a fellow person of Hungarian descent who recently received praise from another Hungarian you might know, Dr. Gábor Máté, another world-renowned trauma expert and author of the book, The Myth of Normal. Gábor said of Peter's memoir, "It's a valedictory ode to humanity, penned by one of the seminal trauma pioneers and master healers of the past half century. This book is the account of a remarkable soul journey from searing pain to joy, from self-hatred to self-love. Its every page is infused with poetic eloquence, dramatic storytelling, unsparing honesty, and touching vulnerability. Prepare to be enchanted and to be instructed, and above all, prepared to be moved." That's high praise from Dr. Gábor Máté. Now, before we drop into today's episode, I do want to note that in this episode, in our conversation, both Peter and I refer briefly to the experience of rape. Welcome, Peter Levine, to Grief is a Sneaky Bitch podcast. I've been looking forward to this for a long time. Thanks so much for joining me.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. So I want you, you all off there, he was just about to dive into one of my favorite topics, which is sort of like the cultural impact of our grief illiteracy. But I'm going to save that for a minute. And I wanted to invite you to answer the question I ask every guest over these past five seasons, helping people start to uncover where their early grief beliefs, that's what I call them, the things that we believe about grief, came from. And for most of us, it came from an early loss in our childhoods, one that we witnessed, and then the behaviors, you know, implicit or explicit of the adults around us. And I know from reading your really powerful memoir, you all, I'm going to drop a link in the show notes, An Autobiography of Trauma, A Healing Journey. I know a little bit about an early loss that you witnessed, your dad's sister. Can you tell us a little bit about that loss and what you think you learned about what grief should or shouldn't look like from the way you know, your parents responded?
I haven't thought about that for a while, actually.
Yeah.
You know, when my aunt, my father's sister died, it was the first time I saw a tear in his eye.
Yeah.
And then my mother said, "Morris, tears won't bring her back." Oh my God, it was like getting stabbed.
Yeah.
And then later, when another aunt died, I was very close to her. And I ran into the bathroom and locked the door so I could cry, so my mother couldn't see me.
Yeah.
And I think we all have, I don't know if it's the same, but some place when we started to feel our grief and somebody or something just stopped it. And and it doesn't go away.
No.
Like you say in your podcast, you know, grief is a sneaky bitch. It just stays there and it grabs you when you're least expecting it. And I think there were two sins. I was saying, you know, in Western culture, I call it corrosive positivism. We're not supposed to be down. We're supposed to get over it. We're supposed to go out and do things or meet new people, things like that. And I think there are two primary sins in Western culture. One is amnesia. We forget.
Yeah.
But it's still there.
Yeah.
And the other one is anesthesia of numbness. And that's something that's shut down in the body that prevents us from feeling.
Yeah, absolutely. That reminds me of some of like Francis Weller's, I feel like, speaks a little bit about that. And and to your point about what you learned, it was one sentence your mom said, right? Yeah. Like the power of what we learn, particularly when we're young, right, by the adults in our life, can be either a sentence of omission, right? It could be what she didn't say, right? And also maybe one single sentence can really change the trajectory of what we believe is okay.
Yeah. Or not even a sentence. I think, you know, mother had been, you know, freer in herself, she would have come up and just hugged me and said, "I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I'm sorry that she died."
Yeah. Right. And to your point,
words, of course, but physicality is at least equally important, at least.
I would agree with that. I often say to people, because you can imagine I get this question a lot, what should I say to somebody who's grieving? Everybody wants the perfect words. And my answer is always, it's actually almost has nothing to do with the words. There's definitely some things to don't say, you know, but it's really about the energetic capacity, the intention, the love, the space that you hold for people that tells everything is way more important. Because you could say beautiful, loving words, but if your energy isn't there, if your intention isn't there, it's almost, it's so problematic. Yeah.
And I think what happens is when somebody is in grief and they start to express the grief, it touches our unresolved grief.
Exactly.
And so then we put the block on them so we don't have to feel it. So
exactly.
It tends to be kind of circular, I think.
It's circular and then it's intergenerational, which I want to touch on later because I know you touch on that a lot too in your work. And to your point, I think often when I'm working, I was just doing a workshop with a whole group of healers at a Forum on Aging conference, and they invited me to come talk about how do we show up for other people in grief. And I spent more than half of the workshop getting people to figure out what their own grief beliefs were and getting in touch with their own grief. Because I do think that we can inflict harm on others if we don't make peace and learn how to care with kind of a mother's love, you know, an idealized mother's love, our own grief, because otherwise we sort of, take that hardenedness that we have and put it on other people.
Yeah, that was beautifully said.
Yeah.
You know, there's another thing about grief. And this is kind of more where my work goes. Yeah. You know, sometimes we have grief. We've lost somebody we love, or a relationship breaks up, or we experience an illness. But also sometimes it comes, I mean, it always has some capacity or some of shock.
Yeah.
But sometimes the shock is really preeminent.
Yeah.
You know, we come in and we see somebody we love dead. Or in many people I've worked with, they've come into a room and seen a sibling or a parent hanging. And that shock, it just shuts the whole body down, the whole organism down. And so we have to work with the shock. I don't want to say first, but we need to work with the shock. Because without getting that somewhat resolved, then it's really, really difficult to get at the grief itself.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because we are shut down. Our nervous system is protecting us. As I always say, it does a really beautiful job protecting us from processing too much too fast. And yet, which I want to talk with you about, it gets stuck and then we can't get to the things that we need to kind of hold space for. I want to spend, especially because you've written so many incredible books over the years, and everyone, I promise I'm going to link all of them in the show notes because you need your library. But I wanted to touch a little bit because you have the courage, it feels to me, and a generous gift to the world in a way, to write an autobiography of your own history of trauma and how you came into the work of creating somatic experiencing, which we're going to dive in today. I promise Peter's going to help us with a little 101.
Right.
What, you know, you shared in your book, you know, your childhood was filled with a lot of trauma, both sort of singular incident trauma, including being raped, but also sort of that ongoing trauma, that sense of unsafety and fear as your father was under threat, your family was under threat, right, from the mafia. Yeah. What, when you look back at how did those early experiences shape you coming into this work? I mean, I'm definitely a wounded healer myself. So many people I know, right?
Exactly.
It's me search, right? It's some sort of me search. Yeah. So what is there something that stands out to you in that time across those traumas, across having a family? It seems to me from your story, sort of your mom even denied that things happen in your life. Right. There was a sort of all of those things. Looking back, what there's a piece of that story that you think is important when you look back all these years later about how you came into this work?
Yeah. Well, like you said, Chiron is the wounded healer.
Yeah.
And when we are in some kind of a healing profession, it's pretty close to 100% that we've had some degree trauma.
Yeah.
And, you know, how do we get to that? Now, one of the things in somatic experiencing is we don't go right for the trauma.
Yeah.
We don't have people relive the trauma or try to change their thoughts about the trauma. But something rather different. And I'll maybe say a little bit about that.
Yeah. Please.
When I decided to write the book, an autobiography of trauma, I had really planned just to journal this in a way for my own healing. Yeah. I had no idea at all to make it into a book. It was just something that. Something that I just felt that I needed to do for myself.
Yeah.
But one of my very, very close friends said, Peter, you really should write this as a book, because I think your healing can really help other people's healing. It's not just like a gushing memoir, but there are really kind of more specific things that can arise. So, but I still was not convinced. And sometimes, or often, if I'm stuck in some way, I'll look to my dreams and or synchronicities, so-called coincidences that might happen. And I had the following dream. I'm standing by this open field, and I have in my hand many sheets of paper with that are typewritten. And I look to one, and then I look to the other, look to the left, look to the right. And I'm conflicted. I can't decide what to do, what I'm supposed to be doing with those pages. And in that indecision, this breeze, this wind comes from behind me and takes all of these sheets and then scatters them to the meadow to land where they may.
There's your answer.
Yeah. That was my answer. It was very clear. It was not easy. It was not an easy task. And especially when the book first came out, and when I gave some talks, related to the book, it was very hard. It was very difficult. It was very, very difficult. Yeah. But you know what really helped me? Actually, the first time was a few weeks ago at the Evolution of Psychotherapy. And that's a big thing. It has, usually 5,000 or 6,000 people.
Yeah.
So I'm there in a pretty big audience. And the title is, of the talk is a healing, an autobiography of trauma, healing journey. And I couldn't get the words out. Mm. I just was,
Yeah.
But I remembered some of the wonderful things that my friends, my colleagues, and other people have written about the book and written about me.
Yeah.
I really felt them by my side, at my back.
So beautiful.
And yes, and I was so moved. I was so moved. Tears came when I spoke.
Yeah.
And, I wanted to be able to welcome them, but I also didn't want to break down.
I know. Too much. I know.
Too much.
But still showing up as your authentic self in that moment.
Yes. Yeah. 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 And I did. And I think each time I did that, in a way, I touched even more deeply into my grief.
Yeah.
And, when people talk about the stages of grief and then you go through the stages and you're done with the grief, I've never heard something I don't want to say stupid, but
it doesn't work that way. No, it doesn't work that way at all. Believe me, we talk about that all the time on this show. Yeah.
Oh, good.
Yeah. You mentioned, thank you for sharing that. First of all, again, just thank you for being like, I'm going to join your colleagues in saying thank you for being vulnerable, for gifting us your story. Because I think the more of us, especially in the healing community, do that, the more we make possible for other people to turn inward to their own, I think is a really true thing. But also you mentioned the sort of synchronicity, or in your case, the dream that happened where, the page is blue and then you're like, well, there's my answer. But as I read your book, you talk over and over again about dreams playing a kind of pivotal role in your life. You have spent many a dream in conversation with Albert Einstein. I mean, you invite some smart people to your dreams, to your
That's right.
To your party. What have you learned about dreams for you, or what might we all want to think about our dreams, or how have dreams served you, do you think?
Yeah. I think what I needed to do was to cultivate a relationship with my dreams. Mm-hmm. It's very easy, wake up and you have a dream, and you kind of go back to semi-sleep. And then when you wake up, you have no memory of the dream at all. Or sometimes parts come during the day. But so one of the things that I really made sure that I would do is as soon as I awoke, I would write something down, maybe some key words about the dream. And then when I would awake, I would kind of look at the dream and the different parts of the dream and see how they impacted my body, how they triggered some feelings, emotions, because all our feelings and emotions exist in the body.
Yeah.
It's not in the mind per se. I mean, there, of course, the mind is part of it, but it's really primarily in our body. And if I think about some of the most important dreams in, well, in writing, but first there was that dream, of course.
Yes. Yeah. But your history of dreams go way back, as I read your autobiography.
Oh, yeah. I'm gifted by dreams. I think we're all gifted by dreams. But if we really make the intention of opening to our dreams, then they're likely to come. This is not exactly true, but this is one way I kind of look at it.
Yeah.
The dreams, of course, come from the unconscious or even the collective unconscious.
Yeah.
They just do. But you have to cultivate a relationship.
I love that. I love that notion. Yeah.
Yeah. Because if you don't do that, the dream world, the unconscious says, forget it. This guy's not really listening to us.
Yeah.
I mean, something like that, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. And so you have to take the dream seriously.
Yeah.
And it's a serious thing, and it can really shape our lives. Lisa, I think about one of the important dreams that happened when I was I was developing somatic experiencing.
Yeah.
And in this dream, I'll get back to Einstein.
Yeah, yeah. No, you're good. Wherever you want to go. I just meant the dreams being an important part. Yeah, yeah.
So anyhow, in this dream, I had met this man in a black robe with a velvet or a purple sash going up from his knees all the way down to his feet.
Yeah.
And I recognized him as some kind of a teacher, some kind of a lama, probably.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so in the dream, he hands me this box. It's a wooden box with a metal sash over our middle belt over it.
Okay.
And he hands me in the dream, he hands me the box. And he doesn't tell me what to do with it, but somehow I know that I'm supposed to go through this door that's on the other side of the room. And I open the door, and it opens to another room. And in that room, there is a safe. And I understand that what I'm supposed to be doing is putting this box in that safe and then locking the safe. Mm. And at first when I woke, I thought, that is really a stupid dream. So I said, oh no, I don't think it is so stupid.
Yeah.
And I realized that in a way, somatic experiencing is built on perennial wisdom of something that's come up in different parts of the world at different times.
Mm-hmm.
And that my job was to keep it safe by putting it into a form that would be acceptable in Western medicine and Western science.
Yeah.
And that was, in a way, keeping this perennial knowledge alive. And again, that was so clear. And it's really almost now, when I've written the book, that I'm willing to talk about some of these very non-linear things.
Yeah, right.
That have happened in my life that have been important. So you asked me the question about the dream with Einstein.
Yeah.
When I was working on my doctoral dissertation, and this was in the early 70s, I was also working on my doctoral dissertation and developing the basic clinical aspect of somatic experiencing. And it was quite a load. And so at the end of the day, I would often go to my favorite restaurant called the Beggar's Banquet in Berkeley on San Pablo Avenue. And they always greeted me by name. Mm-hmm. And the waitresses were very inviting. And so I would sit down. Usually I would start by ordering a bowl of soup along with some French bread that was, you know, like crispy on the outside and warm and kind of moist on the inside.
The treat at the end of a long day, yeah.
Exactly. Exactly. So one of these days, I was sitting there, and all of a sudden, I saw the shadow off to my left. And I looked, and there was this man with really wild hair and a jacket that was like three sizes too big, as so it was all crumpled up. And he didn't ask for an invitation, as I recall, in this waking dream.
Yeah.
But he sat down, and I recognized this was an image of Albert Einstein. Now, of course, the science part of me knew that this was something that's called, oh gosh, what do they call it? Active imagination.
Yeah.
Something that Jung talked about.
Yeah.
And that this wasn't real. Yeah. I mean, it felt like real, but that's what those kind of images feel like. They're, in a way, eidetic, lifelike. And so we started a conversation that lasted for a year. And I would ask him questions. And then the great professor scientist would ask me questions about my questions, kind of like a Socratic dialogue.
Yeah.
And in some ways it was frustrating, but in other ways it really, really opened me up to developing this work and to developing myself.
Yeah.
And so this again went on for considerable amount of time. And then one unanswered question I had was I was starting to realize that many of the people that I worked with, that their traumas didn't occur in isolation. Mm. That they didn't, it wasn't things that happened to them from their parents, but rather things that happened from their parents, 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 grandparents, grandparents.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, I was really, I mean, it didn't make sense again from a scientific point of, at that
right.
time.
At that time. From, now we know we have epigenetics and all these things,
and
right?
Even more than that, you know, exactly. Yeah. It's really clear that these things are not, that happened to us are not just from our, this life.
Yeah. When we come back, Peter continues to share the wisdom he learned from Albert Einstein and the surprising story of their shared history rippling across space and time. You're listening to Grief is a Sneaky Bitch podcast. I'm your host, Lisa Kietfarmer. Everything sucks and other negative thoughts. This is your brain on grief. Oh, the places you go and the people you see and why it's exhausting. People say stupid shit. Watch out for the grief thief. Secondary losses, the sneakiest bitches of them all. The beautiful, messy, emerging you. Those are just a handful of the chapter titles for my forthcoming book, Grief is a Sneaky Bitch, An Uncensored Guide to Navigating Loss, hitting bookstores in June. But you don't have to wait until then to hear more. You can pre-order your copy of the book today at Amazon.com, bookshop.org, or barnesandnoble.com. As a special thank you for pre-ordering, I'm hosting a pre-launch party for everyone who does. It's happening on Zoom on May 22nd, which happens to be my birthday. I'll read some excerpts, answer your questions, dish about the behind the scenes of the podcast, and more. You can follow me on Instagram at Lisa Kietfarmer MSW, then DM me that you pre-ordered the book, and I'll share the party invite link with you. If you're not into that whole social media thing, don't worry about it. You can just drop me a note to info@lisakietfarmer.com. Hey, and I'm also starting to schedule book tour appearances across the country, starting with my book launch on June 4th at Warwick's Bookstore here in San Diego. If you're in the area, I'd love to meet you. But don't worry, if you don't live near here, I plan to hit the road and I'll have dates for you soon. I'm going to be showing up in places like LA, Seattle, Portland, New York, Boston, DC, Chicago, and of course my hometown, Ann Arbor, Michigan. Go Blue. If you want to keep up to date on where I'll be showing up, don't forget to sign up for my not-so-regular newsletter at lisakietfarmer.com/newsletter. I can't wait to meet you, both at the pre-launch party and in your city while on tour, to thank you so much for supporting the show and the book, and really just to take some time to celebrate life together. By the way, if you didn't hear your city named and you want me to come to you, drop me a note and let me know what destinations I should add to my tour. And if you have connections to a bookstore or other fun venue in your area, let me know that too. I'm always up to something new. Like in March, I'm hosting an online workshop exploring the shoulds of grief and then flying to Cincinnati to deliver the keynote address and facilitate a workshop on the Forum on Aging. In April, I'm back online with folks like you, and this time we're going to learn about the healing power of beauty, wonder, and awe. You can find the links to register in the show notes for today's episode or by visiting lisakefauver.com. But truly, I'm a lifelong learner, and I'd love to share my discoveries with you. Whether it's something I learn interviewing new guests, lessons from attendees when I'm delivering a talk, reflections on entering a new stage of my own cancer treatment, to be honest, or even learning something new about grief or loss, healing, resiliency, by reading or taking a workshop of my own. The best way for me to share and to learn more about what you want to learn about is to sign up for my not-so-regular newsletter at lisakefauver.com/newsletter. Why is it called that? Well, because grief isn't on a schedule, and neither is my newsletter.
Right, but go back and back and back. And so anyhow, I was asking him about that.
Yeah.
So in the dream within a dream.
Wow.
He takes me to this pond and he has a yardstick. And on the yardstick are a number of stones. So he takes the stick and then just turns the stick so all of the stones fall together into the pond. And so it ripples out in space and time. It ripples out in front. It ripples out in back. It ripples out in the side. Again, that was something, of course, that I got from Einstein, is that time is not linear.
Right.
It's something very much more interesting. And like he said, there are two ways to look at the universe. One, that nothing is a miracle, and one that everything is a miracle.
Yeah.
And so in looking at these waves, he then showed me where they intersect. Instead of going forward, if they get stuck, then there's a distortion from that moment forward in time and back in time.
Right. Yeah.
And so I asked him, well, how do you work with this? And he said something about, just look at these waves.
Yeah.
And I'm afraid that I can't give you that answer. That answer you have to come to.
Come on, Einstein. Give me some help here, right?
Yes, exactly. But I think he honestly wasn't, I think he didn't know that answer.
Yeah.
But I think he realized that his understanding of space-time relativity
so
would
important.
Be a very good foundation for me.
Yeah.
Okay. So again, I'm a scientist. I see this as active imagination. Einstein really wasn't there. I don't think he was even alive at that point.
Right.
So some years ago, I was visiting my parents in New York, and I had spent the day downtown going to different museums. Of course, New York is incredible
mm-hmm.
museums. And I came back and I rang the doorbell. And as I entered the room, I noticed there's on a shelf, there was a book by Einstein, Theory of Relativity. And it's talking about synchronicities.
Right.
And so I told my parents, primarily my mother, what my encounters with Einstein.
Yeah.
And my mother stiffened. And she said, Peter, I know what that happened, why that happened. And I thought, what?
Yeah.
What is she talking about?
Yeah.
And then she went on to say, when I was 8 months pregnant with you, your father and I were on a canoe out in this lake in New Jersey. And this wind squall came across and tipped the canoe, and they were unable to right the canoe. And so they certainly would have died, would have perished, yeah. And I wouldn't be here. And in that moment of life threat, this small boat came by with an old man and a young woman. And they pulled my parents and me to safety. And they introduced themselves as Albert Einstein and his stepdaughter. Exactly.
I mean, Peter, this is a movie, by the way, just saying.
It's a possibility.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, and again, it's like, do you look at life that nothing's a miracle or that everything's a miracle? And so my mother reasoned that because he saved me,
yeah,
that I would be forever connected with him. Mm-hmm. And he has shown up from time to time in my healing journey.
Yeah.
And yeah. Yeah.
Powerful. Oh, I love that. I bet everybody listening, me included, I mean, I got it from even reading your book too, is going to have maybe, and this is an invitation to have a different relationship with your dreams, for one thing, and to be in relationship with your dreams. I like the way that you named that. And also to be maybe in this way of being in the world about everything being miraculous. I really love that. Thank you so much for guiding us through that story. That was so beautiful. Sure. You know, you mentioned sort of here you are a scientist, you're in your graduate thesis, you're doing some work, but you're starting to have this sense, and this is in the 70s, so probably there's PTSD was maybe just not even as a diagnosis,
no,
right?
Still another 12 years.
So I'm so curious, you know, here you are a scientist, you've experienced multiple layers of trauma already by the time in this life. And I know you had other traumatic or, you know, incidents, including a car wreck years later. But here you've experienced all this trauma, you're studying people, you're in this field, but you're starting to develop this sense of there's got to be a particular way to work with people who've experienced trauma.
Yes. Yes.
Different than, you know, I mean, maybe at the time there was LSD, but there wasn't EMDR, certainly, right, as a trauma modality yet. Like, tell me a little bit about developing somatic experiencing and in the context of what else was even happening at that time.
Right. If you can believe this, at that time, there was one book about trauma, and it was Judith Herman's Trauma and Recovery.
Yeah. Okay.
A very important book.
Yeah. Very. Yeah.
But if you can, I mean, just imagine that.
And now we have entire sections of bookstores.
We have hundreds.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or maybe thousands.
Yeah.
A book about trauma. So it's in the mainstream in a way.
Yeah.
And I was saying, in somatic experiencing, we don't take the person right into the trauma.
Yeah.
Because some of the things that were developed afterwards had to do with what's called prolonged exposure, where you have the person relive and relive and relive their trauma, supposedly emptying the swamp, draining the
swamp. Right. Except
and that. Maybe it can help some people, but with many people, it's quite frankly, it's just re-traumatizing.
Right. Cruel, really. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And so go back to my exploration. I started to have some disturbing body sensations and images.
Yeah.
And so I asked one of my students, a really beautiful healer, wonderful healer, to sit with me and to help me, guide me to work with these images and sensations. And we did. And again, in somatic experiencing, we can always find a way where the person has had an important positive experience. That has similar body body sensations that are resonant with the body sensations of the trauma. So what came up for me at first initially was an event that happened when I was 4 or 5 years old. It was my birthday. And in the middle of the night or early in the morning, my parents laid tracks underneath my bed out into the room, back underneath my bed, like an oval.
Yeah.
And And then when I woke up, the train was going around the tracks. And I jumped out of bed. I leaped out of bed.
Yeah.
I went right for the, I knew what the transformer was because I was interested in electricity.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was controlling the speed and then also tooting the horn. And in that moment, I knew I was cared for.
Mm.
I was loved.
Yeah.
And even if we only have one such incident in our lives when we have felt cared for and loved, we will be okay. We will be able to make it.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things that I wrote, well, sometimes people send me books. They want me to write something in a
book. Yeah, yeah.
So this book came and I was kind of thumbing through it. And I saw this this quote. And I remember thinking, oh, that is exactly how I see it, how I agree.
Yeah, yeah.
And but then I looked and it was actually a quote from my book In an Unspoken Voice.
You're like, no wonder I agree.
Yes.
I agree with myself. Yes.
Yes, right. A little embarrassing.
No.
Anyhow, the quote was, trauma is not so much, or it's not just what happened to us.
Yeah.
But rather what we hold inside in the absence of that supportive, present, empathetic other.
Yeah. And I'm so glad you brought that up because it's as you said, it's so many of us get confused that it's the car wreck, it's the shooting, it's the rape, it's the something. Right. And why do some people rebound differently? But you're really talking about our innate need for belonging and being held and the relational healing that has happened. Anyways, go ahead. Yeah.
There's many of us were deeply traumatized, not just by events,
right,
but a lack of a holding environment.
Right. Lack of attachment. And
a lack of attachment or a problematic attachment.
Yeah.
And I definitely experienced that.
Yeah.
And again, that one took in a way more work than just working with the individual trauma.
Yeah.
And in a way it became a life journey. You know, and I've been blessed by having different, I'm heterosexual. I'm blessed by having different relationship with women over these years where I was able to begin to heal slowly that attachment wound as I could connect more deeply with them and more deeply with myself.
Yeah. You know, do you mind if I read a little passage from your book to you? How do you feel about that? Well, because it's about, I think, but about what you were talking about and introducing the idea of somatic experiencing. It's the passage about being held by your guide as you sort of worked through that positive memory association, bodily association. And I think that might help our listeners to kind of understand what this experience. So, excuse me, you said, "With extraordinary gentleness, my guide placed her hand on my shoulder and brought me back from the deep shock of that dissociation. I sensed the receding of that brutal violation and began to recover my sensory presence in the here and now.
Yeah.
By the conclusion of the session, I discovered that my body could finally do what it couldn't do at the time of the rape.
Right.
Indeed, one of the core principles of somatic experiencing lies in discovering new and more powerful experiences in our bodies, ones that contradict the feelings of overwhelming helplessness that are the hallmark of trauma."
Wow.
Those words too. I mean, quote yourself there. But I think that's underlined a lot in this book, but that was one that I really grabbed too, because I think it was such a beautiful gift, by the way, again, of your own vulnerability, of your own story and experience, but also helping us start to see the ways in which it's about a different way of coming to resolution around our trauma, because we are stuck in that helplessness state.
That's right. That's right.
Right.
You know, Sigmund Freud, before he went off on this Oedipal stuff, he actually said one of the best definitions of trauma. And this was in 1914, 1916, around that.
Well, before there was even Judith Herman's work, right? Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly, around the turn of that other century. And he said that trauma is a breach in the protective barrier against stimulation, leading to feelings of overwhelming helplessness. I would only add to that, trauma is a breach in the protective barrier against overstimulation, leading to feelings of overwhelming helplessness.
Yeah.
And many people, there are many different types of trauma. and we experience, and it's none that is more appropriate than another or more valuable.
Valid. Yeah. We don't need to. I always say that about grief, like people are a grief thief. Sometimes they want to compare, is your grief worse than others? And to your point, what you're saying is, it's so important to name that there are different sources of trauma, but there's no value in rank ordering.
That's right. And that's one of the things I've learned in working with people for over 50 years.
Yeah.
Is that, and it's more than anything, trauma is a breach in the capacity to be in the here and now. Yeah. And the gift of healing trauma is to be more present, to be more in the here and now.
And to be able to take Einstein's words, which is to be able to be in the here and now means to be able to look around and recognize everything as a miracle.
Yeah. And like you wrote, or I wrote and you read that to complete a situation, to do the things our body wanted to do, but it couldn't do then.
Yeah.
When I would get home from school, I would go across the street and climb this right orange fence, go down and run through the bushes because there was a track below, a running track.
Yeah.
And I would start to run and I could feel, and my guide said, yes, just feel that in your legs. And I could feel that movement, that sense of power, that sense of mastery of my body.
Yeah.
And, but one day, I was climbing over the fence, and there was a group of kids. They obviously were like thugs. They were smoking cigarettes, and they had these Marlon Brando hats.
Yeah, yeah.
And I knew something was wrong. I didn't know what it was. But then as I went down into the bushes, they grabbed me and violently threw me to the ground and raped me. And the reason they did that, as I later pieced together, is that they wanted my parents to know that their life would be threatened if they ever testified against Johnny Dio, the mafia don. Yeah. But I never told my parents about that.
Yeah.
I was too filled with shame. I think in a way, I didn't even tell myself about it. Until I really was able to work through that and return to the power in my legs, and of course I couldn't get rid of these. I couldn't push these people away. I mean, they were, you know, waves stronger,
bigger,
and there were several of them, not just me.
Yeah.
And most people with trauma, we deal with that by dissociating.
Yeah, yeah.
We separate from it, maybe not completely, but parts of it are now disconnected from other parts of it.
Yeah.
And so in that session, when I could feel again the power in my body, the power in my legs, I came to peace with that. I came to peace with myself and felt deep waves of self-compassion and compassion for others.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I was honored that I could, like in the dream, be able to keep this in safekeeping and to teach people. Because initially, this was a lot of weight on my shoulders because I knew I had to get this work out.
Yeah.
And it was quite a burden.
Yeah.
You know, the story of Johnny Appleseed who planted apples all across the country by planting seeds. That's what I was doing with, this way of working with somatic experiencing. But it was a big burden. It was.
Yeah.
But it's not now because I have 50 wonderful, incredible teachers.
Yeah, you've trained
so many. 44 countries. They've worked now with about 60, 70,000 people who are traumatized. Yeah. So to the question, have I done enough? I've been able to say affirmatively, yes, I have done enough. The other question, am I enough? That was a work in progress. And that also had to do with deepening my processing of grief.
Yeah. I want to dive into that. Thank you. First of all, thank you for allowing us to hear that and to sharing that story and to being vulnerable. I appreciate that. I've shared on the show before, I'm also a rape survivor, and I recognize that that piece, you know, you talked about that dissociation that most of us experience. And I'm just curious on your thoughts before we sort of, I want to talk a little bit about grief, trauma, and somatic experiencing and the relationship there. But to those of us listening who've also maybe haven't named dissociation for ourselves, but are maybe coming to recognize that we've been living dissociated, I often say, like the word stress, I think dissociation gets a bad rap, right? Like we dissociate, thank goodness, because how could we possibly process our utter helplessness? We just can't live in the dissociation.
That's right.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, we would have been destroyed.
Yeah.
We would have been annihilated because we don't have that capacity when we're children to process that.
No.
I mean, it's rarely, you know, a child can be guided for this, but it's quite rare. And and dissociation gives us enough distance to survive and then to visit that dissociation when we have greater capacity, when we're feeling more support and more guidance.
A safe container, right?
Enough container, right? It's again that empathetic, that present empathetic other who's really holding us.
Yeah. Yeah.
And yeah.
So just like, I appreciate that. And just like trauma has all these different sources, we have different kinds of trauma, that my work really is about expanding what we know to be the sources of our grief and also what grief actually is, which has an emotional, physical, cognitive, relational, spiritual impact, not just feeling sad, right? It's a 360. So in my mind, trauma, not all grief is traumatic, but all trauma includes grief. Right?
Absolutely, because something was lost.
Exactly. Safety, identity.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. And when we lose something, and there are so many different kinds of losses.
Yeah.
I mean, you lost your husband.
Yeah.
Exactly. And then you had cancer.
And then I had cancer. So I've lost the sense of myself this year. I've lost a friend. I've lost others. Right. Yes.
Yeah. Exactly. And we have. Yeah. I mean, at my age now, you know, some of my friends have died.
Yeah.
And I still have tears. You know, I'm going up to LA to get a flight. I'm doing a retreat in Costa Rica.
Oh.
And usually when I would go up to LA, it was to visit my dear friend Butch. And I was expecting to see him, you know,
this
Wednesday.
Time. Yeah.
And I realized I wouldn't.
Yeah.
I would never see him again.
Yeah.
Though I hold him in my heart.
We're holding him too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, the other thing is when I was able to return to that 18-month-old child who, even though had experienced trauma, still in some way was alive, was vital.
Yeah.
And I can just show you this.
Yeah, yeah.
I hope I have it.
I think I saw that of little you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. These are also some of the people who have greatly influenced my work.
Is this you?
Yes. Oh, there you go.
Oh, you all watching on YouTube.
And in the last chapter is called Living My Dying.
Yeah.
And it's really just reconnecting with this wonderful, vibrant, alive child.
Yeah.
Who's still there.
Yeah.
And to be touched again by him.
Yeah.
In a way was the conclusion of the book for now.
For now, right. That's just this chapter of this book. Yeah. You know, so I think a lot about, as I've learned a little bit out of your work, of course, I followed your work for years. But even just reading this book, thinking about back to your sort of problematic with our myth of like, we're going to move through five stages or we're just going to heal and we're going to be done versus life being a sort of never ending, you know, healing process, yeah. is that to move inward through this process of somatic experiencing or yeah. any healing modality that folks listening are going through mm-hmm. is to actually unpack layers of other losses that mm-hmm. may be what we call secondary losses to the primary losses. And so sometimes people get confused that it's making us worse because now all of a sudden we're, you know, sort of opening the Pandora's box.
Yeah.
Right. Of all of our losses.
Yeah, this is something I want to say, which is also a principle in somatic experiencing.
Yeah.
We take, when we work with people, again, we just work with one small amount of a sensation or an image at a time.
Yeah. Yeah. As we begin to wind down our conversation, Peter shares one of the most profound principles of somatic experiencing, titration. Using that classic slinky toy to help us understand how experiences move through us and what happens when we feel too much too soon. I'm your host, Lisa Kefauver, and you're listening to Grief is a Sneaky Bitch podcast. I want to share a formula with you that I think you might find interesting. 100% of us experience grief, plus we spend the majority of our waking hours in the workplace equals grief is in your workplace right now. It's true. Remember, it's not just death loss. We experience grief in the wake of relationships ending, diagnoses, layoffs, high turnovers, restructuring, relocations, and even frightening and traumatic world events. Having been both an employee and a leader in deep grief over the years, 5 years ago, I set out to create impactful programming that helps organizations create a grief-smart and more compassionate culture. I've been fortunate over the years to deliver keynote addresses for mental health conferences, partnered with school districts to offer half-day intensives for educators, and offered ongoing workshop series on grief, loss, burnout, resiliency for a wide range of clients from Fortune 500 companies, to medical residency programs, hospice organizations, and other social service entities. Conference planners have invited me to lead Ask the Expert panels, and leaders have also trusted me to offer consultation on specific situations facing their company. The surprising thing that they all had in common, it's that these opportunities all came from listeners like you. So if you're part of an organization or company that is impacted by grief, which, as we learned in the formula in the beginning, that means all of us, reach out to me at lisakefauver.com and we can work together to make your organizational culture grief smart. I recently received this moving review on Apple Podcast, and it touched my heart so deeply that I wanted to share it with you. Allie Moncrief said, "I began by cherry-picking from these amazing podcast episodes, ones that seemed to fit with what I needed as I navigated traveling to see my gravely ill brother on the heels of losing our dad and our family home. Then I just ended up listening to whichever one came next because they're all so good. There are so many profound pearls of reality and wisdom in these conversations, and I am so grateful to have found Lisa's podcast. As I travel this path, I honestly have a ton of fear. And I'm in awe of the energy that has allowed me to be just where I am with my brother. Lisa's particular grace and communication around grief have really helped support me in this wickedly challenging moment. Thank you. Thank you so much." Thank you, Allie, for sharing. Friends, 5-star ratings and beautifully written reviews like these not only help the algorithm get the show out to more grievers who might need it most, it also inspires me to keep bringing you more and more important conversations. I'm 5 seasons into the show, and I love every bit of the process. The hundreds of thousands of downloads tell me that, yes, people are listening, but it doesn't really tell me what it means to listeners like you. So I humbly ask you, if you love the show, if one or more episodes have helped you in some way, please take the time to head to Apple Podcast or Spotify, subscribe to the show, click the 5 stars to leave a rating, and then click the pencil icon to write a review. Those few minutes it will take you to do that will mean the world to me, truly.
I call that titration. You know, actually, I just realized this summer I'll be doing one of my classes in Germany, and I think the name of the class is Grief, Joy, and Embracing the True Self.
I love that. Well, I'm going to check into that. But you just brought up something really important there, which I think is one of the many things that I love about somatic experiencing, this way of healing trauma that you've created, are these concepts of titration and pendulation, so that even, which I'd love for you to tell us a little bit about, because I think even if somebody listening isn't working with a somatic experience trained therapist, it's a concept that when I first learned about it years ago, really helped me think about how I was going to work with my grief. And, you know, so can you tell us a little bit about titration and pendulation? Yeah.
Actually, I hope I have it. Yes, I did. I have two, titration and pendulation.
Do you have your famous slinky?
I do.
All right.
And it's
fantastic.
A real, it's the old kind.
Old school.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. When I was probably about 3 years old, 3 or 4 years old, I would just make them go down steps. I was just enamored.
Yeah. Right.
It was a miracle.
Rightly so. It is a pretty cool toy. Yeah.
So what happens is when we are threatened, we mobilize a tremendous amount of energy, life-preserving energy. And so this energy is released.
Yeah.
And if we were to go back all at once, this what happens is, again, if we, for example, look at an animal that's a prey animal, that it may be, its life may be threatened, you know, many times in a day. And if they're not eaten, they're not going to, the most of the time, they're not going to develop symptoms like human PTSD. In the laboratory, you can do that. But in their natural.
In nature, it's not.
Yeah, wild animals. So again, if they're threatened, they're going to usually run and to escape or fight. So if they're running, all of this energy is being expended.
Yes.
And then if they're brought down, all that energy gets locked in. With a wild animal, when the coast is clear, they'll very often come back and that energy will continue to run to escape, and this time to successfully.
Sort of completion, to successful completion of that energy exertion. Okay, yeah.
When people are prematurely exposed to that, there can be an explosion of energy. Yeah. And often the person is overwhelmed. And again, that's what trauma is. It's about being overwhelmed.
Yeah.
So the idea is to just gently touch into a sensation or a feeling and then let it come to equilibrium. I don't know how you
see that. Yes.
And then again, releasing a little bit more and then coming to equilibrium and then releasing more. Until
to having that sort of wild, chaotic release, which many of us have experienced either as a trauma survivor or if we've been in relationship with a trauma survivor, that looks like explosive, over outsized reactions, anger outbursts. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Rage. Yeah.
Rage is a big one. Yeah. So you're talking about titrating as just helping people gently in a safe container be a little bit at a time.
That's right.
Gradual.
A little bit at a time, because before it was too much, too soon.
Too soon.
Yeah. So the other important component of somatic experiencing is what I call pendulation.
Yeah.
So when a person first touches into these sensations, which they've been alienated or dissociated from, they'll feel a contraction. And again, we probably are going to be avoiding that. So the person has to be guided that yes, there is a contraction, but every contraction is followed by an expansion.
Yeah.
And every expansion by another contraction, and another expansion, and another contraction, and another expansion. Again, what I call pendulation.
Yeah.
And if maybe, 100 years from now, probably the only thing I'll be known for is the word pendulation.
Pendulation. And you're slinky, and maybe Albert Einstein, right? Yeah, no.
Maybe. Actually, one of my colleagues was very upset that I wrote that section about Einstein because he thought it was very unprofessional.
Yeah. Well, but
my commitment to myself was to follow my truth wherever it would lead. Again, that's when I was just doing it for myself. Yeah. But I carried that on to the book itself.
Which is so important. I say that over and over again on the show, and I have guests, and why I even share my own stories, parts of my own story sometimes, is if we don't see it out there, because somebody else didn't have an Albert Einstein conversation probably, but they had some other thing that was resonant to that. And if we don't hear the people that we respect also sharing their experiences of our lived experience, then we turn inward with that self-hatred or that denial in a way. So I'm glad you ignored your colleague out there, and I'm glad you brought that story forward. You know, I think titration and pendulation will be important.
By the way, the same similar thing with grief.
Yeah.
People have, again, this fear of grief.
Yes, exactly.
And in a way, it's not unfounded.
Yeah. It's hard.
It's hard. And I think it's critical. I mean, one of the things I suggest, you probably have, come to this yourself, is, to take time, if the grief is there, to take time to be with the grief.
Yeah, exactly.
But also to take time to not be with the grief.
Yes, you have to take a vacation from it too.
Yeah, a distraction, a vacation, to do other things. I think it's important because, again, the key in, we can't use the word resolving because it just makes no sense at all.
It's the ing. We're so embracing
for grief is to just do, again, a little bit at a time and pendulate with it.
Yeah.
Go into the grief, come out from the grief.
Yeah.
Go into the grief, come out of the grief.
Yeah.
So yes. I think that's so important. Otherwise, we may just become phobic of our grief, and that's not going to be helpful.
Exactly. I'm so glad you brought that up. And yes, that is definitely something that I talk about often. And I think, our eschewing of the grief, our compressing it, that we do individually, but that we've learned to do culturally. Yeah. Because it's all part and parcel, is what makes the hard work of grief harder, right? Yeah. That's the unnecessary, grief is hard, and then there's this layer of unnecessary suffering. And I think that's in part because of the ways in which we've sort of demonized or eschewed or put in a closet this idea of grief. And so compartmentalize it as if we can somehow compartmentalize, our lived experience. We like to think we can.
Well, again, that's, another aspect of dissociation.
Exactly. Yeah. And so, yes, I agree. For those of us listening, whether our grief had a trauma component or not, this wisdom of titration and pendulation is so important so that we can withstand the discomfort and learn to be with discomfort, because life is that. But the more we do that, the more we return to our sense of our own power, our own agency, our own capacity, right? And we know that we can move through hard things. And the more we do that, the more we're capable of doing that. Yes. It's a cyclical. I appreciate that so much. Yeah. I cannot believe already basically an hour has gone by, but I wanted to just close our conversation with not in that toxic positivity, or what did you call it?
Corrosive positivity.
And a conversation I've been having with a lot of folks in this space lately is when we are working in our healing, ing, right? We're not at the ED, but when we're moving with our healing, healing ourselves, I believe I've experienced, all the folks I've worked with over years experiences, that you can unlock a kind of capacity for, as Dechner Keltner calls it, awe or wonder or joy or creativity. Can you tell me a little bit about what you're learning personally, or what you've learned in your work around sort of access to joy, life purpose, creativity? What do we need to know?
I think it was Jung who said, embrace your grief, for then your soul will grow.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think almost all of the great pioneers have something to say about grief.
Yeah.
Yes. It's part of the human condition. I wrote somewhere, the courage to love that which death will claim for her own.
Yeah. Right?
And I think that is. To love is takes courage.
It does, because 100% of us will lose someone and 100% of us will die. And it takes courage to embrace love, embrace joy, and embrace the lightness of life, the serendipity of life. Yeah. The ups and downs of life. Yeah. I say all the time, you know, we want to have our emotions and our experiences a la carte. I'll take the good things.
Right.
The happy.
It's not like water faucet.
It's not,
one in, one off, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. How is there?
You're not feeling or you're feeling.
Exactly. Exactly.
You're numb or you're feeling.
Yeah. Yeah. Is there a joy that is coming to you as you now, because now you're out, you've put this book out in the world, you're going on shows like mine, thank you very much, and talking about it. Is there any kind of release, a joy in the creative process of this?
Yeah. I mean, again, that 18-month-old child, you just see his joy.
Yeah.
You know, everything is like new and wonderful and wondrous.
And you're sort of embodying that version of you again.
Embodying that. And I mean, in a sense, that was what the whole book was about, me embodying my joy. I mean, to see one of the things that I think one of the people wrote. This is from Gabor, who's a really good friend of mine.
Another Hungarian. Exactly. Another Hungarian. I need to have him on my show.
He's wonderful. Big heart. Very heartful.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. Valedictory ode to humanity, penned by one of the seminal trauma pioneers and master healers of the past half century. This book is the account of a remarkable soul journey from searing pain to joy, from self-hatred to self-love.
Yeah, I agree.
Every page is infused with poetic, so forth and so on.
Yeah. Well, I agree with Gabor. Cheers to the fellow Hungarians in the room.
Yeah.
Peter Levine, thank you so much for joining me today on Grief as a Sneaky Bitch. This is, I hope, maybe the first of many conversations, but this was such a delight. And thanks for sharing this, your story, with us and with the world. And everybody, check out the show notes and get yourself his library. Thank you so much.
Sure.
Well, friends, whether you knew something about somatics or somatic experiencing before the podcast today or not, my hope is that our conversation offered you some insight into your own attempts to heal in the wake of loss or trauma, and perhaps a spark of hope, too. I encourage you to check out Peter's entire canon of books, including his newest one, An Autobiography of Trauma, A Healing Journey, available on Amazon.com or wherever books are sold. You can learn more about somatic experiencing at traumahealing.org. Now, don't forget, you can pre-order my forthcoming book, too, Grief is a Sneaky Bitch, An Uncensored Guide to Navigating Loss. And when you do, don't forget to message me to get yourself an invite to that book pre-launch party celebration. Oh, sign up for that not-so-regular newsletter to learn if I'm coming to a city near you on my upcoming book tour. This season, I've committed to releasing the unedited version of these episodes on my new YouTube channel at Lisa Kiefhofer, MSW. Thank you for listening, and if you found it helpful, don't forget to share it on socials and tag me at Lisa Kiefhofer, MSW. And of course, if you loved it, leave a 5-star rating and write a review. Thanks again to Mike Moody at Permanent Record for the audio engineering support, and Guile Smith of Alafia Sounds for providing the music. Until next time, I see you, I hear you, and I'm holding you in my heart.